This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest Bernie Brillstein has been a manager for at least two generations of TV and film stars. His clients have ranged from Norm Crosby to John Belushi to Rob Lowe. He came up for the idea for Hee Haw, the country music TV show, and he's produced movies like Ghostbusters and Dangerous Liaisons. In partnership with Brad Gray, Brillstein pioneered an intensive style of management that made him part agent, part friend, part babysitter. Brillstein writes about many of his clients in his new book, Where Did I Go Right? You're No One in Hollywood Unless Someone Wants You Dead. Brillstein got his start in showbiz in the mailroom of the William Morris Agency, and his uncle Jack Pearl was a comedian in the Ziegfeld Follies. I asked him about the early days.
First of all, our house was filled a lot of times with show business personalities. And even though I was a little kid, I sort of got the idea that they were important.
Uh-huh.
And secondly, he used to take me to all the wonderful clubs on the east side of New York, the Star Club, Tut Shores, the Harwin. And there I'd see the people who actually ran New York and probably the world. I'd see Joe DiMaggio. I'd see Jackie Gleason. I'd see the ex-mayor of New York, Jimmy Walker. I'd see everyone. And I decided then someday I'd really like to be part of that.
So you're like at Tut Shores getting Shirley Temples with Frank Sinatra or something?
Not exactly, but I did have, my uncle did set up a lunch with Joe DiMaggio once. I remember that.
Really? What was that like?
Boring. I mean, he wasn't a man known to speak a lot, and I'm sure he was doing it as a favor to my Uncle Jack and Aunt Winnie,
uh-huh.
But all I did was stare at him, and he wore a beautiful blue suit and a solid blue tie and a light blue shirt, and he looked like Joe DiMaggio.
Uh-huh.
And I got an autograph, which I'm sure I sold.
All right.
And I did something silly, too. But it was great to remember those. I did see Jackie Gleason and Frank Sinatra drinking at the bar
uh-huh.
with Tut Shores a lot of times.
What was the Club Samoa?
Aha. That's my father's life. That's the west side of New York.
Uh-huh.
That was on 52nd Street between 5th and 6th Avenue. It was known as the street in those days. It was all the jazz joints where Billie Holiday and Dizzy Gillespie and, oh God, Miles, everyone played. And there were about 15 clubs on the street, all owned by or controlled by guys in the mob. And in the middle of all this was this Club Samoa, which was basically a place where men went to meet women. And Madison Square Garden was on 50th, between 50th and 51st and 8th Avenue. And my friend Norman Cartagena and I would go to the ball games at the Garden. And then my father would have a club sandwich and a Coke waiting for both of us. I looked around and I knew it was happening, but I may believe I didn't. And it was, they used to call them bust-out joints. If a guy would come in, he'd sit with a girl, and then they'd go up on stage and do sort of a strip, and another girl would come over and sit with him.
Uh-huh.
So it was interesting combination of two lives.
And what did your father do?
He was in the millinery business. He made hats, and he was also president of the synagogue.
Now, you say that watching Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis at the Copacabana really hooked you on show business. What was it about their act that made it seem so exciting?
Well, if I could set the time a little bit, I really started out where I could go to places myself. I had gone to see Lenny Bruce and Ray Charles at Carnegie Hall, and that really excited me. It was new and different, and I was amazed how great it was. Then my mother took me to the Capitol Theater. The movie was Dorian Gray, and I think second billed, the band was Xavier Cugat, and underneath were Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, who I never heard of. And I had never seen something that made me laugh as much. Jerry Lewis actually jumped off the stage, came running through the crowd, and they sang, they danced, and there was something about them that just got to me. A year or two later, they were at the Copacabana, which was the best nightclub in New York. Not the classiest, but the best, where careers were made. And I saw them 21 days in a row, and they went on to become Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. Now, I know it's fashionable today for people to make fun of Jerry Lewis. Jerry Lewis then and now is a great comedian, a great showman, and he taught me a lot about the business. And seeing him perform with Dean, Jerry was 6'2", Dean was 6'3", and handsome. They sang together, they danced together, and did an amazing act. Mm-hmm.
Did you yourself ever want to be a performer?
I didn't have the guts. Uh-huh. I certainly, look, I mean, talking to you scares the hell out of me. I mean, I'm always so used to being behind the scenes and for doing this for the people I represent that this is a whole new experience for me.
Uh-huh. So how did you decide that you wanted to be behind the scenes? How did you, what was your concept of being a manager? How did that come
to you? Oh, I had none. When I started out at William Morris, I just wanted to get into show business.
Yeah.
I stayed there 8 years and found out everything I didn't want to do.
What didn't you want to do?
Well, I didn't want to represent the company and not the artist. Everything, well, this is heresy, but it's the truth. Everything William Morris does, or a lot of it, is for William Morris.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, clients usually came in second. And I saw what was done and by whom, because when I left William Morris in 1963, it was being run by accountants and lawyers, which was never my favorite thing to run anything, especially a show business company.
Mm-hmm.
So I left to become a manager. The fellow who managed Jack Parr just left MCA and was opening his own management company. And he offered me a very good deal to go over there. And I did. And I didn't have any concept except to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And my first client that I signed, Jim Henson came over from William Morris about 2 months after I went there. That's Jim Henson and the Muppets.
Mm-hmm.
And this was before Jim became Jim Henson. But I believed in him. And the first client I signed, who's been my client now for 35 years, was Norm Crosby, a malaprop comedian who's still my client.
Uh-huh.
And I liked helping the people run their creative lives. It was us against the world, us against the agents, us against the networks, us against the movie studios, and it was like being married.
You mentioned agents, and I think a lot of people confuse agents and managers. I mean, in your book, you say, you know, what's the difference between an agent and a manager? And you say 5%. But really,
that's one of my silly offhanded remarks.
But yeah, but it has a basis in truth.
It does.
And I just think it would be interesting for you to explain to people who don't really know the difference between an agent and a manager.
Okay. An agent is licensed by the state as an employment agency. You sign a contract with them. They have exclusive rights to sell you and get employment for you. A manager, certainly in my case, I've never had a contract, but we can do everything but get employment for clients. We take care of them with the agents. We take care of them with the lawyers, with the middlemen, with the networks, the studios, the nightclub owners, the Broadway producers. We're the guy who makes it work between the star and the buyer. That's our real job.
Uh-huh.
The manager is there all week long. The agent shows up the night of the show.
Uh-huh. My guest is show business manager Bernie Brillstein, author of the new memoir, Where Did I Go Right? We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bernie Brillstein. His new book is about his life as a show business manager. You were in, I think, your mid-40s when you helped launch The Muppet Show and helped sell NBC on the idea of Saturday Night Live. I wondered if you felt like a middle-aged guy handling a younger generation that you didn't necessarily identify with.
Well, let me give you a tiny bit of background on that. My dad always told me from 20 to 40, you lay the groundwork for your career. From 40 to 60, you collect. And after 60, you can screw it up any way you'd like. So here I was, successful, but not really successful. I certainly made more money than most people know what to do with. I was respected, but I hadn't become that thing. Does that make any sense? I hadn't become...
A presence that people knew?
A presence that people both paid attention to, feared, and respected. I don't know in which order, but any of the above.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Henson had been with me since 1960. He went on Sesame Street in 1967 or 9. I think 9, 1969. I had tried to sell The Muppet Show for 6 years and couldn't because the geniuses and the research at the network said puppets wouldn't work at night. Finally, the path led me to Lou Grade in England, who believed the Muppets were great because they had done the Julie Andrews show, our variety show, when there was variety. And he gave me an order for 24 shows and put it on the CBS owned and operated stations. And that became an overnight hit. Saturday Night Live, which came before the Muppets by 6 months, was all the doing of Lorne Michaels, who was a Canadian writer who I had signed when he was writing Laughing and stayed with. And he had this idea: Bernie, I'd love to do a television show for people that were brought up on television. I thought that was a great idea. I didn't know how aware, hip, and ahead of the curve Lorne was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to get back to your question, which you asked about 30 minutes ago, I guess. I never felt older than them because they treated me with such respect.
Mm-hmm.
Belushi treated me fantastically. Aykroyd treated me fantastic. They didn't know about agents and managers. That's how unsophisticated the business was at that time. And that was only 24 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They knew I represented Lorne. They knew Lorne was smart. Therefore, they knew that I was smart. So they treated me fantastically. And every once in a while, I came up with something intelligent for them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we really all loved one another. It was us in the trenches against the suits at NBC.
Right. Well, you're very blunt in the book about John Belushi's use of drugs. What was it like to have to manage someone who seemed pretty determined to mess up his life?
I don't know if you've ever been involved with anyone who did drugs. I hope not. I have, both personally and in business. The laws of this country do not allow you to commit anyone for help. Mm-hmm. They have to commit themselves. So although you know it, you never think it's as bad as you find out later it was. And in 1975 to 82, when John died, he always said to me, I have the heart of a high school senior, and you take the care of me from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. After that, my life is my own. So he was an adult. I couldn't commit him. Did I ever think he used the drugs they said he used at the end? No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I still don't believe it, because John was petrified of needles. But he certainly was excessive. He was excessive in his comedy, he was excessive in his eating, and obviously he was excessive in his drug use. But did I think he was going to kill himself? No.
Mm-hmm.
No.
But he would come to you and ask you for money for drugs?
No. He asked me the last day.
Uh-huh.
He never asked me. Look, people offered me drugs in front of him, and he would smack their hands and say, don't you dare insult Bernie.
Uh-huh.
So John never did drugs in front of me and never admitted that he did drugs in front of me. We would talk about him doing drugs, but he never once said to me, I'm going to go out and do some cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't the relationship. It was like a father and son.
Mm-hmm.
So I owed him a birthday present. His birthday was January 29th, I believe, or 30th. I mean, right around there. And this was a few days, it was March, and he said, you still owe me a birthday present. So I said, okay. He said, I found Les Paul's guitar at the Guitar Center, and the guy won't take anything but cash, and he wants $1,800. Now, the answer is yes, I gave him the money.
Mm-hmm.
Did I believe it was for the guitar? You bet I did. He was an actor. I didn't know I was giving him $1,800 to buy drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really didn't. Now, was I found guilty by myself? You bet I was.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I left town for about 6 months because I had to get away from it. I went to Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's very sad to lose a friend, who was 33, from drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened again with Chris Farley.
There's a very dramatic scene in the book where you describe actually that you were the person who had to take Belushi's body back east, I guess it was, after he
to
died.
To Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, you were the only person who would go in the plane with him.
No, I was the only person in California who actually was responsible to bring him to Martha's Vineyard where he wanted to get buried.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there was a crowd waiting to fly in the West Wind, which is a very small plane, with a body bag.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't very pleasant for 7.5-8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You have to realize, I flew him in on Sunday, and it was only 2 days after this shock had hit me. So sitting there with the body bag, and with my memories, and with my anger, and with my really despair, it wasn't a very nice trip.
We're talking to Bernie Brillstein, the author of Where Did I Go Right? You're No One in Hollywood Unless Someone Wants You Dead. Now, in the midst of all this, you're dealing with some of the most cutting-edge performers at the time. It seems pretty odd to me when I read the book that a New York, L.A. guy like you should come up with the idea of hee-haw.
Well, you have to go back for that.
Yeah?
I hadn't been able to sell the Muppets for a long time. And it really frustrated me. So I went home one night and I awakened at 3 o'clock, where I do my best thinking, really. And I had the idea, okay, I'll give them what they want. The top 10 at the time was Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Laughin'. And I broke them down and I said, how about a country Laughin'? And I sold it the next day with Pepe and Nailsworth to Perry Lafferty and Mike Dann of CBS. And George Slaughter, who created Laughing, still kids me that he deserves a royalty for that and The Muppet Show.
One of the things I like about the book is when you said, I want careers, not quick hits. And that makes sense as a manager, because you want a client with a long, profitable life. But, you know, how do you prevent a client from doing something that you think might bring him or her some short-term gain, but do some long-term damage to his career?
Okay. Someone offers you $75,000 a week, your client, to do a situation comedy that's not written by the best situation comedy writers. It's certainly not written by David Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
That you know is just a fill-in for the network. It's cannon fodder. Sometimes the client would like to take 13 times 50, which is $650,000, and be able to put that money in a bank. My theory has always been, if they're willing to give you a deal now when you're a virgin, in other words, you haven't been in a series,
mm-hmm.
why not wait for a good one? If you're going to take the giant step, how about trying to make it work and trying to know the time period and trying to know whose auspices it's under, rather than just taking the money? It's a constant battle between career and money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I was an actor and someone came up and offered me $20 million to do a bad movie, I'm really being honest with you, I'd have a tough time turning it down.
So is it your job to help him say no?
That's correct. Or help him say yes when it's only $250,000 and he's getting $3 million a picture, which Jerry Harrington in my office did for Nick Cage with Somewhere in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Nick had made 3 movies in a row, comedies, 2 of which were good and 1 which wasn't. So the price he had on movies was about that time, $2 or $3 million, I don't know, very high. And we thought it was time that Nick, and I think Nick thought, that we reminded everyone what a great actor he was. So it's a very difficult choice, because you never know if you're right. I swear, you never know.
My guest is show business manager Bernie Brillstein, author of the new memoir, Where Did I Go Right? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bernie Brillstein, co-founder of the Brillstein Gray Production Company. His new book is about his life as a show business manager. How did you meet your partner, Brad Gray?
It's a great story.
And form
it's
that
really
company.
It's really a great show business. I've had the company since 1969. And, you know, through all the success and failure we had, I always said to the people working for me, with the reputation we have and with the clients we have, why don't you go out and get some more clients and we'll make this thing bigger? Because I was busy with Jim Henson and Lorne and Belushi and Aykroyd and Padgett and Tarsus, who wrote Buffalo Bill, and Norm Crosby. And everyone just stared at me because things were going well. And at the time, I think we had only had five people in the office. And then in 1985 or 4 or 6, I think it was 1984 probably, I went to cover a show that Telepictures was doing in San Francisco. And it was a club date, a one-nighter. And the comedian was Gary Shandling. Now, I knew he had his manager there, Brad Gray, who I had never met. And being brought up in a polite home in Manhattan, I thought it was rude of me not to go backstage and say thank you, it was a terrific show. Although, in all honesty, I didn't think Shandling was that funny. So I went backstage, and there was Brad, and we started talking. And he said, I'd love to come up and see you someday. I said, why don't you come over and play tennis someday? He started playing tennis with me. Then I went to Hawaii, and as someone in my office, Mark Gervich, tells the story, Brad knew I was going to Hawaii and was at the same hotel, or as Brad says it, it was pure accident. Now, you figure it out. So I would bet on the latter a little bit, probably, because Brad is really smart.
Given all the experiences you've had, why did you trust Brad Gray to be...
I'll tell you. We talked and talked and talked, and then one day I got a phone call from Brad, hyperventilating. So they have to see you tomorrow morning. At the time, I ate every breakfast in the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel. I said, meet me there at 8 o'clock. I said to my wife at the time, because I've had... This is my fourth wife, and the only one we really talk about. This is going to cost me $25,000. I have a kid in trouble. Because Brad was only 25 at the time. So I go to breakfast, and he's like hyperventilating. He spits it out, and he says, with your knowledge of production and with your knowledge of the business and people, I can bring you all the young talent in the world if you'll teach me production. Therefore, he gave back to me my own words. And I said, okay, let me think about it. But, you know, I never wanted to spend the money, to tell you the truth, to expand. I was very happy with this mom-and-pop business. But I thought about it, and I liked Brad a lot. And then I said, let's do it. And 5 years later, I made him my partner. And 6 years later, or 5 years after that, he bought me out. It's a great story. And I still work there for him.
Now, you've sold the company to Brad Gray.
That's it.
Fairly recently. And you say in the book, I was old, he had become the driving force in the company, and my ego couldn't take it. Now, that seems to me to be very honest. How hard was that? It must have been difficult for you.
It's terribly difficult. You know, I think the title of the chapter is It's Not Good Not to Be King Anymore. When I'm used to getting all those phone calls saying yes, no, yes, no, and that was the final word. All of a sudden, about 40% of those phone calls don't go to you anymore. And people are very nice and polite about it. No one was rude. But, you know, I've been around a long time. I know when I'm not that powerful anymore. I'm more powerful now because I'm back to my basic business, which is taking care of talent. I'm having the best time with Rob Lowe. I mean, on West Wing. He's great. It's a great show. John Larroquette, Marty Short's television show, Wayne Brady. I mean, I could go on and on. It sounds like an audition. But I'm back to basics. I'm handling. You don't know a young comedian by the name of Brandon Bolin.
No.
He will be a big star next year.
Okay. Brandon Bolin.
Yeah, that's how B-O-W-L-I-N. Because that's how I started developing all this talent. And Brad now has taken our company into the millennium. He is going to be an amazing force in the business. I'm still there. I'm in the office next to his. I'm along for the ride. And I'm holding my own with everyone. I'm also like the consultant for the, you know, to all the young people in the company.
Uh-huh.
I still know some tricks. You know, it's pretty nice.
Well, thank you very much, Bernie Brillstein. It's really been nice talking to you.
You've been great. Thank you very much.
Bernie Brillstein is the author of Where Did I Go Right? You're No One in Hollywood Unless Someone Wants You Dead.